Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 59, special COVID-19 edition number 7, but who's counting? It's Friday, April 24th. I am coming to you from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, which still looks eerily like my den as I shelter in place. I hope you are all staying safe, protecting yourself and others. Well, just when you thought it couldn't get any more surreal, our carnival barker-in-chief rambles on about injecting disinfectants into our bodies, or maybe, quote, hitting our bodies with light. This after demoting the head of the pandemic task force and, wait for it, replacing him with a former Labradoodle breeder. Yes, you heard that right. A former Labradoodle breeder. You can't make this stuff up. Well, folks, step right up and drink the Kool-Aid. But remember, don't forget to add bleach to it. You certainly can't trust that colored Kool-Aid. And now, news from the Senate. In a staggering act of compassion and unmatched federal assistance, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that states having financial troubles due to the pandemic should consider bankruptcy. In a tip of the hat to our morally bankrupt president who has used successfully bankruptcy as a business model throughout his fantastic career. Bankruptcy for everybody. Please note, credit card or student loan debtors need not apply. You don't qualify. Thank you, bipartisan bankruptcy bill. And news from the state of the states. This week's state leadership award goes to Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, for insisting on opening up state businesses before the state even meets the pathetically weak federal guidelines. And in completely unrelated news, the Georgia Bulldogs will now be named the Georgia Guinea Pigs. Citizens from around the country have been wondering how gyms got on the list of businesses to reopen first. Award winner Georgia Governor Brian Kemp is exercising his anti-science muscles by following the ill-advised federal guidelines and ordering gyms open. This from CNN. With lobbying push, gyms get on phase one of Trump's reopening plan. When President Donald Trump revealed his guidelines for opening up America again last week, among the bolded names of businesses and institutions that could reopen were restaurants, movie theaters, and places of worship, so long as they adhered to strict social distancing protocols. Tucked near the bottom of the list, right above a warning that bars should stay closed, was a curious inclusion, gyms. While an integral part of many Americans' routines, gyms and fitness clubs would seem to present a particular risk of contact spread of a contagious virus. Filled with people sweating and breathing hard, sharing equipment and spaces, gyms are in many ways the last kind of business to prioritize during a deadly pandemic. Their inclusion follows a last-minute lobbying push by an industry not known for flexing its muscles in Washington. While not every major company was part of the effort, Conversations with 10 leaders in the fitness club business reveal an influential network of relationships that kicked into gear over the past few weeks and helped move gyms to the front of the line, even to the surprise of many in the industry. And some executives who spoke to CNN expressed some hesitance at a lack of federal guidance dictating what measures they should follow when they reopen. Adam Zaitsev, the CEO of Gold's Gym, said that even in Mongolia, even in Mongolia, where Gold's Gym also operates, the government has mandated distances between members, a quota capacity for gyms, and guidelines about testing employees. Matthew said gyms with large numbers of people coming in and out of the building is likely going to be a huge health hazard. You can imagine in a gym setting, if you just trace people from weight to weight, if one person is infected, he or she can infect three or four people around them, and then the chain begins. And in other news about feudal and feudal orders, from KCRG in Iowa. Iowa meat plants will stay open despite virus risk, Reynolds says. Governor Kim Reynolds said Monday that Iowa's meatpacking plants will stay open and continue to spread the coronavirus among workers, warning that shutting them down would be devastating for farmers and the food supply. Reynolds acknowledged at a news conference that the virus spreads quickly and easily at the plant because so many workers are in close proximity. She said that we will continue to see clusters of positive cases in them. Reynolds said closing them wasn't an option, calling the state's most important objective, quote, keeping the food supply chain moving. Otherwise, she warned that farmers would have to euthanize animals scheduled to be sold to plants and the price of food would skyrocket. Reynolds said even operating the plants at 50% capacity is more realistic option than closing them entirely. But the director of health, the health department in Black Hawk County, where officials report an outbreak at the Waterloo Tyson Foods fresh meats facility, is connected to at least 150 cases of the coronavirus, said that might not be possible. What we've heard is that there hasn't been a good amount of employees to even run the plant, Nafisa Cease Ebugwani said. He said that more than 90% of Black Hawk County's 356 cases as of Monday were reported after the outbreak at the Tyson plant was identified, and because of a backlog of public health investigations, they believe more cases are connected to the plant than they currently know of. Meanwhile, Mercy One Covenant, a local healthcare organization, said Monday that it's starting to see a surge in hospitalizations and infections. And in this continuing saga, from the Hill, Tyson Foods closes Iowa pork plant indefinitely after coronavirus outbreak. Tyson Foods is suspending operations at its pork processing plant in Waterloo, Iowa, because too many workers have been absent due to the coronavirus pandemic. All 2,800 workers of the plant will be asked to come in for coronavirus testing, which will determine the timing of its opening. The lesson from this, if you think governors and CEOs are in control of this pandemic, think again. Ignoring scientific realities won't give you magical superpowers. This virus will shut down businesses if you don't. Well, back to national news. The feds have called up the Keystone Cops to give chase in search for personal protective equipment in a little something they call ragtime. This from Salon. States smuggle COVID-19 medical supplies to avoid federal seizures as House probes Jared Kushner. States have been forced to resort to smuggling shipments of personal protective equipment, PPE, after federal officials seize supplies ordered by hospitals without informing officials. Governors have long complained that the Trump administration has left them to bid against each other on the open market for critical supplies for health workers. However, numerous officials recently claimed that the federal government has seized supplies ordered by states. Colorado Governor Jared Polis, a Democrat, told CNN that the state bought 500 ventilators before they were, quote, swept up by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker, a Republican, said the Trump administration confiscated its order of 3 million masks. Now states and hospital officials are concealing shipments of supplies from the federal government in order to avoid detection. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, a Democrat, recently secretly bought millions of masks and gloves from China. He kept the details under wraps because they've heard reports of Trump trying to take PPE in China and when it gets to the United States. A source familiar with the situation told the Chicago Sun-Times. The governor has clearly outlined the challenges his administration has faced as we've worked around the clock to purchase PPE for our healthcare workers and first responders. The supply chain has been likened to the Wild West, and once we have purchased supplies, ensuring they get to the state is another Herculean feat. Dr. Andrew Artenstein, the chief physician executive at Bay State Health in Massachusetts, revealed in a letter published in the New England Journal of Medicine that he was questioned by the FBI after the hospital worked around the clock to secure a shipment of PPE. Deals, somewhat bizarre and convoluted, and many involving large sums of money, have dissolved at the last minute when they were outbid or outmuscled, sometimes by the federal government. Then we got lucky, but getting supplies wasn't easy, he wrote, detailing the measures his supply chain team took to get the equipment. Two semi-trailer trucks, cleverly marked as food service vehicles, met us at the warehouse. When fully loaded, the trucks would take two distinct routes back to Massachusetts to minimize the chance that their contents would be detained or redirected, he recalled. Before he could send the funds to wire transfer, two Federal Bureau of Investigation agents arrived, showed their badges, and started questioning me. No, this shipment was not headed for resale or the black market. The agents checked my credentials, and I tried to convince them that the shipment of PPE was bound for hospitals. After receiving my assurances and hearing about our health system's urgent needs, the agents left the boxes of equipment but released and loaded to be released and loaded into the trucks. But I was soon shocked to learn that the Department of Homeland Security was still considering redirecting our PPE. Only some quick calls leading to intervention by our congressional representative prevented its seizure. Conservative pundit David Frum said the letter was, quote, like a story from the last days of the Soviet Union. Senator Mark Warner, Democrat, Virginia, said he heard about the seizures firsthand from law enforcement and healthcare workers. It has got to stop, he tweeted. The administration is supposed to be coordinating this, not making the problem worse for our hospitals and first responders. Representative Jerry Nadler, Democrat of New York, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, and a group of House Democrats called on FEMA to provide any documents related to the seizures. Officials and healthcare providers in California, Florida, Washington, Illinois, Oregon, Alaska, and Texas have described similar experiences, the lawmaker said in a letter to FEMA Administrator Peter Gaynor. FEMA must explain their actions. The seizures had already come under scrutiny from two other House committees after the New York Times reported that Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, had surprised FEMA officials by redirecting supplies. Kushner himself said during a White House coronavirus briefing that he had supplies delivered to New York after Trump got a call, quote, from his friends about the conditions in the city's hospitals. Though the FEMA operation is overseen by Gaynor and Navy Rear Admiral John Plowswick, the logistics chief for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Kushner has lead of a so-called shadow task force staffed with former startup entrepreneurs, according to the Times. The group has clashed with senior officials, one of whom described the team as, quote, a frat party that, quote, descended from a UFO and invaded the federal government. House Oversight Chairman Carolyn Maloney, Democrat of New York, and Homeland Security Chairman Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi, called on Gaynor to explain the role of Jared Kushner in managing FEMA operational efforts to obtain and distribute supplies. It appears that Mr. Kushner is unclear about basic facts regarding the purpose of the Strategic National Stockpile, the lawmaker said, citing Kushner's claim that our stockpile is not supposed to be the state stockpiles that they then use. The lawmakers were troubled that Kushner may be circumventing protocols that ensure all states' requests are handled appropriately. We are particularly troubled that Mr. Kushner's work may even involve directing FEMA and HHS officials to prioritize specific requests from people who are able to get Kushner on the phone. In other news, under the category of failed state, this from MSN, mass incarceration could add 100,000 deaths to U.S. coronavirus toll, study says. America's addiction to mass incarceration could almost double its number of deaths from coronavirus, with jails acting as incubators of the disease and spreading a further 100,000 fatalities across the U.S. The startling warning comes from groundbreaking modeling by the American Civil Liberty Union and academic researchers. The analysis found that unless instant action is taken to reduce jail populations, a terrible price will be paid. Jails, which house men and women not yet convicted, will act as mass vectors of the contagion. as many as 99,000 more people could die in the U.S. as a result of the virus being contracted behind jail walls, the study predicts. Of those, 23,000 are projected to succumb behind bars and 76,000 in surrounding communities as a result of inmates spreading the virus upon release. The projection would almost double last month's White House modeling of COVID-19's grim legacy in terms of lives lost. When it comes to COVID-19's deaths, mass incarceration is our Achilles heel, said Udi Ofer, director of the ACLU's Justice Division. The U.S. is truly exceptional among countries grappling with the coronavirus in that no other nation incarcerates people on such a scale, which in turn has critical implications for the threat posed by such an outbreak. The U.S. accounts for 4% of the world's population, but 21% of its incarcerated population. The ACLU modeling, developed by epidemiologists from Washington State and universities of Tennessee and Pennsylvania, focuses on the 740,000 people held in U.S. jails. Conditions inside such institutions are often even worse than in the notorious prison system and amount to a COVID-19 perfect storm. Jails are so overcrowded there is virtually no possibility to place inmates 6 feet apart, and sanitation is often rudimentary. There is a huge churn in jail populations. On average, inmates spend 25 days inside, and many just a day or two, creating a revolving door between institutions and surrounding communities which the virus can exploit. Add to that churn the bald fact that there are almost 11 million admissions into U.S. jails each year, one every 3 seconds, and the potential for jails to act as vectors of disease is evident. Inmates come burdened with a relatively high incidence of underlying health conditions, such as diabetes and asthma, are vulnerable to contracting the virus while incarcerated, and can quickly carry it back to their communities. Projection that mass incarceration could cause an extra 99,000 deaths is almost certainly an undercount, as the research did not take into account either prisons or immigration detention centers. Those institutions have a more sedentary population but are still highly vulnerable to contagion. Just how easily coronavirus can spread behind the bars is illustrated in Ohio, where more than 1,800 prisoners at the Marion County Correctional Institution have tested positive, 73% of the total prison numbers. Across the state as a whole, 1 in 5 confirmed COVID-19 cases are among incarcerated inmates. In Cook County Jail in Chicago, almost 400 inmates have tested positive and 6 have died. About 225 staff have also tested positive and 1 correctional officer has died. The ACLU agrees that the lesson of its research is that mass incarceration has become a major health threat to all Americans, not just those locked up. The solution, the advocacy group contends, is to reduce the jail population as quickly as possible. Only 5% of more than 10 million arrests in the U.S. each year are for violent offenses. Most people end up in jail are there for low-level infractions, including failure to meet bail terms. Some states and jails have made inroads in tackling the crisis. Colorado has reduced its jail population by 31% since the pandemic began, Los Angeles County by 25%, and even Republican-leaning Kentucky by 28%. Of course, in Ohio, that Marion County, the numbers are even higher than when this report was posted. It is now the largest single source of COVID-19 infection in the country. Woohoo! Ohio rules. And just south of Columbus in Pickaway County, it joins Marion County as number one and number two counties in Ohio with highest infection rate. Lucas County thanks you for bumping us to number 4 behind number 3 Mahoning County. Good old reliable Youngstown, our partner in leading in public health tragedies. Well, this week's show is a milestone in that today we are 32 days into Ohio's sheltering in order. Why is this a significant milestone? Because by now, new cases reported should be a reflection of our state's epidemic while practicing physical distancing measures. This can give us a better grasp of whether what we are doing now is enough to slow or stop the epidemic, or at what level the epidemic may continue. I've been keeping close tabs, and there is little evidence that new cases are in any kind of systematic decline in either the state or Lucas County. The prison outbreaks have driven new cases higher than a couple weeks ago. Lucas County has the highest rate of identified cases in nursing homes, accounting for almost 1/4 of total cases in the county, and indicative of a continuing epidemic rather than a systematic decline. Our rate of cases is increasing faster than the rest of Ohio, and this is even with the skyrocketing cases in Ohio prisons elsewhere in the state. Some good news, we haven't caught up with the overall national rate yet. Though for some comparison, Lucas County has a higher rate than any county in California. Overall, the net direction of physical distancing is loosening, not tightening or even holding steady. Based on cell phone data, the U.S. has moved from a C-minus grade to a D+. Ohio has held relatively steady at a D-minus, ranked 45th out of 50 states for effectiveness of social distancing. Lucas County edged up slightly from a D-minus to a D, with a slight improvement in limiting non-essential visits. Lucas County is in the middle of the pack of Ohio counties, ranking 43 out of 88 counties, but among metropolitan counties, we rank 7th out of 8 counties. So, what does physical distancing look like in the U.S.? We have some answers from a new Gallup poll. From Gallup, American social contacts during the COVID-19 pandemic. Adults practicing social distancing generate at least 90% fewer contacts per day than those who are making little effort to social distance, according to new Gallup data. Those who completely or mostly isolate themselves generate about 5 contacts per day, compared to an average of 52 for those not attempting to isolate themselves. According to March 27th through April 9th Gallup panel survey, work is the largest source of close contact Americans have outside of household members, accounting for roughly half of all contacts. Working in retail, hospitality, and manufacturing generates the largest number of contacts. Yet, closing workplaces may not be the only way to mitigate contacts and suppress viral transmission. Workers who visit their work site but have made changes in how their job reduced contacts from 29% to 69%. Why measuring contacts matters. In epidemiological models, social distancing has large effects on expected infection growth. Yet different modeling teams have used varying assumptions for the efficacy of social distancing when it comes to reducing contacts. Getting these estimates right would thus appear crucial in accurately understanding the risks and rewards of different mitigation policies. As reported in previous Gallup articles, the majority of Americans, 74%, have been mostly or completely isolating themselves from people outside their household since March 27th. But isolation falls to 67% for workers, as opposed to 84% of non-workers. Only 3% of adults and 4% of workers have not made any attempt to isolate themselves. Since March 27th, the majority of contacts for adults outside the household have occurred at work, 52%, whereas a smaller but still large share have occurred at the grocery store, 26%. No other category accounts for even 10%, but one's home is the third largest at 8%, or fewer than one contact per day on average. If respondents work in grocery stores or other locations, they were asked to count those only as part of their workplace. These data suggest that closing workplaces is an important strategy to reduce disease transmission. Despite going to work, the large majority of workers, 84%, who visit their workplace report that they have made changes to their job to avoid catching the virus. These changes appear to have reduced contacts. Those not taking steps have a mean number of 33 contacts, but those who have taken mitigation steps have 25 or 11 contacts on average, depending on the extent to which mitigation has made it harder to do their jobs. So this is an interesting differential. Okay, so if they haven't made any changes, there's 33 contacts on average. If you answered to the question, yes, it has made it harder to do my job, then that 33 drops down to 25 average contacts. But if you say, yes, and it has not made it harder to do my job, it drops from 33 down to 11. So clearly, the ones that actually it's harder to do your job are still only reducing their contacts from 33 to 25, which just indicates that some workplaces are just really hard to reduce the number of contacts that you have. This is why, of course, why, you know, opening up business is going to be really difficult, because a lot of those workplaces don't really have very good ways to limit the number of contacts they have. Okay. In summary, these data provide evidence that the self-isolating practices of most Americans are dramatically reducing daily contacts when compared with pre-pandemic estimates of daily contacts from people who are making little effort to isolate themselves. Work generates the majority of contacts, with contacts particularly high in retail and hospitality, which have been mandated to close down through much of the country. Manufacturing workers who may be making essential products also generate a large number of contacts relative to workers in other industries, and their jobs are more likely to require in-person work. Fortunately, workers making an effort to change how they do their job appears to mitigate the number of contacts by significant margins. This suggests that reopening businesses could be consistent with disease suppression. Gallup will continue to monitor and report on the practice workers and businesses have adopted to reduce disease transmission. So, should we be looking at loosening physical distancing? We can look to the experience of other countries to get some insights. This from MSN. Why Hong Kong is extending coronavirus restrictions, even as new cases dwindle to zero. Hong Kong achieved a remarkable milestone on Monday. Zero new cases of coronavirus. It's a sign that the latest social distancing measures set to expire this week helped to end the spike in infections the city saw in late March and early April, as residents, many of them students, returned home from U.S. and Western Europe. But instead of declaring victory, officials have announced that they are extending the restrictions for another 2 weeks at least. This is not the time to be complacent. If we relax, the good work that we have done will be in vain, said the city's top official. The conservative approach to Hong Kong's administration provides a sharp contrast to the United States, where some leaders are pushing to lift restrictions and reopen the economy as quickly as possible. Experts say it will be a while before life can go back to normal. We need a bit more time to try to stop the chain of transmission in the community, David Hui, a respiratory medicine expert at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, said. Hui believes that restrictions should be in place until 28 days or two virus incubation periods have passed with no new locally transmitted cases. And even then, he says, any sort of reopening should follow a phased approach. Officials reported four cases on Tuesday, though all of them were people who had traveled recently from the U.S. or the U.K. Hui cautions that reopening the U.S. too quickly could undo the gains that have been made from the lockdown so far. If they let go too early, they may follow the footsteps of Hokkaido or Singapore and suddenly have a major outbreak. Japan's Hokkaido, the country's second largest island, is facing a second wave of infections after lifting its original state of emergency on March 19th. Singapore has seen case numbers surge in recent days, driven by an explosion of infections in migrant workers' dormitories. It will hit you all of a sudden, says Hui. Okay, well, the reality in the U.S. is that community transmission is still widespread, even endemic. We, my friends, are playing with fire.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Oh, the question is, what will it take to get the U.S. epidemic under control enough to substantially reopen businesses? A new study by a range of experts has weighed in. This from MSN. 20 million COVID-19 tests per day needed to fully open economy. With President Donald Trump saying he wants to lift stay-at-home novel coronavirus orders and open up parts of the country, more than 45 economists, social scientists, lawyers, and ethicists say there's a growing consensus pointing to a major step necessary to put Americans back to work, dramatically upscaling testing. The report says that ending the quarantine safely will require testing, tracing, and supported isolation, a combination known by the acronym TTSI. Again, that's testing, tracing, and supported isolation, TTSI. What people need to recognize is that a massively scaled up testing, tracing, and supported isolation system is the alternative to national quarantine, said Danielle Allen, lead author and professor at Harvard. We all had to learn personal protective equipment, PPE. We all had to learn about flattening the curve. Now we have to learn about TTSI, testing, tracing, and supported isolation. Test producers will need to deliver 5 million tests per day by early June to safely open parts of the economy by late July, according to the report. To fully remobilize the economy, the country will need to see testing grow to 20 million a day. We acknowledge that even this number may not be high enough, according to the report. You can think of it as a Marshall Plan. You can also think of it as Eisenhower's highway infrastructure, building all those great roads across the country, Allen said. What we really need is for the federal government to set up a pandemic testing supply board that will coordinate the supply chain and achieve the massive ramp up as quickly as possible. Some politicians have expressed skepticism in the federal government's ability to muster the political power to accomplish this type of testing that will be required to fulfill Trump's ambition to economically reopen the country as quickly as possible. One of the biggest challenges with COVID is the number of people who are asymptomatic carriers, Allen said. It's hard to zero in on the number, but 20 to 40% of people who have the virus are asymptomatic. That means you've got a whole lot of people out there spreading the virus around, and we haven't been able to do anything about it. The new report says testing for the virus alone is not enough. The panel calls for large-scale contact tracing of people. Those human contact tracers or disease detectives notify anyone who might have been exposed to the virus and recommend they get tested. Contact tracing represents a tried-and-true health tool used to control the AIDS epidemic in the United States and other pandemics. It means calling people, finding who they have been in contact with, and then contacting these individuals and having individuals quarantined at home for 14 days and have them call in to see if they report symptoms, said Crystal Watson, a senior scholar at Johns Hopkins and one of the lead authors of the recent study. If those contacts are quarantined at home, they do not expose anyone else, and hopefully the transmission chain ends with them. The Johns Hopkins study recommends investing $3.6 billion to hire and train 100,000 contact tracing personnel. The new report goes even further, recommending hiring hundreds of thousands of contact tracers. The key, experts say, is testing and tracing fast enough so the virus doesn't spread, getting the time frame down from days to hours. The report details four specific phases of reopening the economy and ending the lockdown. These phases are: Phase 1, May through June, 40% of the population, including all essential workers, which includes healthcare workers, firemen, police, sanitation, etc., will be tested and their contacts traced. Phase 2, from June through July, 70% of the population goes back to work, including workers directly supporting the health sector, such as delivery, service, construction workers, building engineers, maintenance, and food workers. The government makes massive infrastructure investments. Phase 3, from July through August, 80% of the population is back to work, including those who must work at locations and in offices. Phase 4, August through March, that's March of next year, people, all workers return to work and schools reopen. Continue to take precautions until a vaccine is widely available, but the lockdown is over. How much will it all cost? According to the bipartisan team who worked on the report, implementing its plan would cost between $100 and $300 billion over 2 years. But Allen suggested comparing the price tag to the astronomical cost of the shutdown is accumulating. Collective quarantine is costing us $350 billion a month, and we've seen the massive unemployment numbers. Allen believes the roadmap can help America create capacity for a pandemic-resistant society, one that is far better equipped to test for the next viral disease to come down the pike. But she also worries that partisan politics might squash the bipartisan purpose behind the plan. This has to rise above politics, Allen said. It's about all of us succeeding. No one wants to go to a baseball game and not feel safe. That's what we need to know to reopen the economy. Okay, well, one potential tool that has been much touted is antibody testing. So where are we with antibody testing? This from the New York Times. Antibody tests, seen as key to reopening country, does not deliver. A law firm in Scottsdale, Arizona, tested employees who hoped with a prick of a finger to learn if they might be immune. In Laredo, Texas, community leaders secured 20,000 of the new tests to gauge how many residents had been infected. In Chicago, a hospital screened firefighters to help determine whether they could stay safely on the job. In recent weeks, the United States has seen the first rollout of blood tests for coronavirus antibodies, widely heralded as crucial tools to assess the reach of the pandemic in the United States, restart the economy, and reintegrate society. But for all their promise, the tests, intended to signal whether people may have built immunity to the virus, are already raising alarms. The Food and Drug Administration has allowed about 90 companies, many based in China, to sell tests that have not gotten government vetting, saying the pandemic warrants an urgent response. But the agency has since warned that some of those businesses are making false claims about their products. Health officials, like their counterparts overseas, have found others deeply flawed. Tests are frankly dubious quality. Tests of frankly dubious quality have flooded the American market, said Scott Becker, executive director of the Association of Public Health Laboratories. Many of them, akin to home pregnancy tests, are easy to take and promise rapid results. And the federal guidance that does exist is so confusing that healthcare providers are administering certain tests unaware that they may not be authorized to do so. Some are misusing antibody tests to diagnose the disease, not realizing they can miss the early stages of infection. People don't understand how dangerous this test is, says Michael Osterholm, an infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota. We sacrifice quality for speed, and in the end, when it's people's lives that are hanging in the balance, safety has to take precedence over speed. Even as government agencies, companies, and academic researchers scramble to validate existing tests and create better ones, there are doubts they can deliver as promised. Most tests now available mistakenly flag at least some people as having antibodies when they do not, which could foster a dangerously false belief that some people have immunity. And even if the tests do improve, their availability could be hampered by the same manufacturing shortages that have prevented the COVID-19 diagnostic tests from scaling up adequately. In Laredo, officials discovered the tests they received were woefully inadequate. The local health department found them to have a reliability of about 20%, far from the 93 to 97% the company had claimed. A police investigation led to a federal seizure of the tests. It's a real mess, Dr. Osterholm said. This is the wild, wild west in terms of testing, and at a time when we need a real definition of what these tests mean. More than 90 companies have jumped into the market since the FDA eased its rules and allowed antibody tests to be sold without formal federal review or approval. Their products vary. Some test only for a transient antibody that spikes while the body is in the throes of an active infection, an antibody that peaks about 4 weeks after infection and typically marks longer-term immunity is a separate target. There are tests that look for both antibodies. Others also look for a third involved in respiratory infections. The most reliable ones involve a laboratory technique called ELISA that can indicate the amount of antibodies a person may have. Researchers are not certain that people who have recovered from COVID-19 have immunity, though it would follow the usual pattern for viral infections. Higher levels of antibodies generally mean a stronger physiological response, but it is unclear what levels are needed for immunity to the new coronavirus, or how long it might last. We're really far from that, Dr. Osterholm said. We're not even in the second inning of a 9-inning game at this point. Most of the tests offered are rapid tests that can be assessed in a doctor's office, or eventually even at home, and provide simple yes or no results. Makers of the tests have aggressively marketed them to businesses and doctors, and thousands of Americans have already taken them, costing a patient roughly $60 to $115. Rapid tests are by far the easiest to administer, but they're also the most unreliable, so much so that the World Health Organization recommends against their use. Most are manufactured in China. Reports of countries that quickly bought millions have just as swiftly been followed by accounts of poor performance. For example, Britain recently said the millions of rapid tests it had ordered from China were not sensitive enough to detect antibodies except in people who were severely ill. In Spain, the testing push turned into a fiasco last month after the initial batch of kits it received had an accuracy of 30% rather than the advertised 80%. In Italy, local officials have begun testing even before national authorities have validated the tests. This month, the FDA warned that some firms marketing antibody tests in the United States were falsely claiming that they had formal federal approval or that they could diagnose COVID-19. In an effort to speed up access, the FDA apparently did not fully consider how these tests would be administered. The agency released a guidance document saying that the antibody test could be performed at, quote, point of care settings, indicating that doctors, nurses, and others could give them to patients in their offices. But agency officials also acknowledge that under federal law, if a test has not been authorized by the agency, it must be conducted in so-called high-complexity laboratories, like some large commercial facilities or public health labs. The officials declined to provide additional clarification. If you're getting an antibody test and it's being conducted in your physician's office, it's a red flag, said Kelly Roblowski, Director of Infectious Disease Programs for the Association of Public Health Laboratories. No action has been taken against doctors, but as companies realize the ambiguity of the federal guidelines, some change course, shifting to lab-based tests or pursuing formal federal approval, which allow their products to be used at doctor's offices and even at home. The FDA has received requests for emergency use authorization from 120 antibody test developers. So far, it has granted formal approval to just four. While political leaders and some health officials say that antibody testing will be essential to reopening the country, it is unlikely to meet expectations anytime soon. Less than 5% of the U.S. population may be infected. And even in hot zones like New York and New Orleans, the prevalence may not be higher than 10 to 15%, according to Dr. Osterholm. In China, early screening in hard-hit Wuhan indicates that only about 3% of the population had antibodies against the new virus. When the proportion of people exposed is that low, the test's false positive rate, signaling antibodies where there are none, can limit the test's utility. Even Celex's FDA-authorized test has a false positive rate of about 5%. That is still a significant margin of error. In a community where 5% of people have had the virus, Dr. Osterholm said, there would be as many false positives as true ones. What are you going to do about that? Are you going to say that you're not going to distance, he said? I don't think that would give me peace of mind at all. Some tests on the market without federal approval are likely to have even higher false positive rates. It is unclear how these companies have validated their tests or how they stack up against one another. President Trump has said that once the federal government has finished validating the antibody tests, manufacturing will swiftly meet demand, but that may not be realistic. Surprise, surprise. Most companies are buying rapid tests from China, though they are unsure if and when they will become available. Early on, Chinese businesses could sell their products freely, but now Chinese officials have signaled that only antibody tests approved by the country's government can be exported. So far, China's National Medical Products Administration has authorized only 11. A startup in Los Angeles, Scanwell Health, expected to receive 1 million tests each week from Innovita, one of the 11 companies, but it is still waiting for its first shipment of 10,000, which was scheduled to arrive 3 weeks ago. Companies and health officials are also predicting shortages of the reagents and components required to assemble the tests. As many scientific challenges as there are right now, said Scott Hensley, leading the University of Pennsylvania study, there's an equally large engineering challenge and scalability challenge to get these on the market. Of course, the whole issue of antibody testing itself begs the question of what immunity even means in this pandemic. So this from the New York Times. Who is immune to the coronavirus? Written by Mark Lipschick, an expert in infectious diseases. Among the many uncertainties that remain about COVID-19 is how the human immune system responds to infection and what that means for the spread of the disease. Immunity after any infection can range from lifelong and complete to nearly non-existent. So far, however, only the first glimmers of data are available about immunity to SARS-CoV-2, the coronavirus that causes COVID-19. What can scientists and the decision makers who rely on science to inform policies do in such a situation? The best approach is to construct a conceptual model, a set of assumptions about how immunity might work based on current knowledge of the immune system and information about related viruses, and then identify how each aspect of that model might be wrong, how one would know, and what the implications would be. Next, scientists should set out to work to improve this understanding with observation and experiment. The ideal scenario, once infected, a person is completely immune for life, is correct for a number of infections. The Danish physician Peter Panum famously figured this out for measles when he visited the Faroe Islands between Scotland and Iceland during an outbreak in 1846 and found that residents over 65 who had been alive during a previous outbreak in 1781 were protected. This striking observation helped launch the fields of immunology and epidemiology. And ever since, as many other disciplines, the scientific community has learned that things are often much more complicated than they think. One example of more complicated is immunity to coronaviruses, a large group of viruses that sometimes jump from animal hosts to humans. The SARS-CoV-2 is the third major coronavirus epidemic to affect humans in recent times, after the SARS outbreak of 2002-03 and the MERS outbreak that started in 2012. Much of our understanding of coronavirus immunity comes from SARS and MERS, which have infected comparatively small numbers of people, but from the coronavirus that spread every year, causing respiratory infections ranging from common cold to pneumonia. In two separate studies, researchers infected human volunteers with a seasonal coronavirus and about a year later inoculated them with the same or a similar virus to observe whether they had acquired immunity. In the first study, researchers selected 18 volunteers who developed colds after they were inoculated, or challenged, as the term goes, with one strain of coronavirus in 1977 or 1978. Six of the subjects were re-challenged a year later with the same strain, and none were infected, presumably thanks to protection acquired from their immune response to the first infection. The other 12 volunteers were exposed to a slightly different strain of coronavirus a year later, and their protection to that was only partial. In another study published in 1990, 15 volunteers were inoculated with the coronavirus. 10 were infected. 14 returned for another inoculation with the same strain a year later. They displayed less severe symptoms and their bodies produced less of the virus than after the initial challenge, especially those who had shown a strong immune response the first time around. No such human challenge experiments have been conducted to study immunity to SARS and MERS, but measurements of antibodies in the blood of people who have survived these infections suggest that these defenses persist for a long time, 2 years for SARS, according to one study, and almost 3 years for MERS, according to another one. However, the neutralizing ability of these antibodies, a measure of how well they inhibit virus replication, was already declining during the study periods. These studies formed the basis of an educated guess of what might happen with COVID-19 patients. After being infected with SARS-CoV-2, most individuals will have an immune response, some better than others. That response, it may be assumed, will offer some protection over the medium term, at least a year, and then its effectiveness might decline. Other evidence supports this model. A recent peer-reviewed study led by a team from Erasmus University in the Netherlands published data from 12 patients showing that they had developed antibodies after infection with SARS-CoV-2. Several of my colleagues and students and I statistically analyzed thousands of seasonal coronavirus cases in the United States and used a mathematical model to infer that immunity over a year or so is likely for the two seasonal coronaviruses most closely related to SARS-CoV-2, an indication perhaps of how immunity to SARS-CoV-2 itself might also behave. It is true that infection creates immunity in most or all individuals and that the protection lasts a year or more. If it is true, then the infection of increasing numbers of people in any given population will lead to the buildup of so-called herd immunity. As more and more people become immune to the virus, an infected individual has less and less chance of coming into contact with a person susceptible to infection. Eventually, herd immunity becomes pervasive enough that an infected person on average infects less than one other person. At that point, the number of cases starts to go down. If herd immunity is widespread enough, then even in the absence of measures designed to slow transmission, the virus will be contained, at least until immunity wanes or enough new people susceptible to infection are born. At that moment, cases of COVID-19 have been undercounted. At the moment, cases of COVID-19 have been undercounted because of limited testing, perhaps by a factor of 10 in some places, like Italy as of late last month. If the undercounting is around that level in other countries as well, then a majority of the population in much, if not all, of the world is susceptible to infection. And herd immunity is a minor phenomenon right now. The long-term control of the virus depends on getting a majority of people to become immune through infection and recovery or through vaccination. How large a majority depends on yet other parameters of the infection that remain unknown. One concern has to do with the possibility of reinfection. South Korea's Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently reported that 91 patients who had been infected with SARS-CoV-2 and then tested negative for the virus later tested positive again. If some of these cases were indeed reinfections, that would cast doubt on the strength of the immunity the patients had developed. An alternative possibility, which many scientists think is more likely, is that these patients had false negative tests in the middle of an ongoing infection, or that the infection had temporarily subsided and then reemerged. South Korea's CDC is now working to assess the merit of all these explanations. As with other diseases for which can be difficult to distinguish a new infection from a new flare-up of an old infection, like tuberculosis, the issue might be resolved by comparing the viral genome sequence from the first and the second periods of infection. For now, it is reasonable to assume that only a minority of the world's population is immune to SARS-CoV-2, even in hard-hit areas. How could this tentative picture evolve as better data come in? Early hints suggest that it could change in either direction. It is possible that many more cases of COVID-19 have occurred than have been reported, even after accounting for limited testing. One recent study, not yet peer-reviewed, suggests that rather than, say, 10 times the number of detected cases, the United States may really be more like 100 or even 1,000 times the official number. This estimate is an indirect inference from statistical correlations. In emergencies, such direct assessments can be early evidence of an important finding or statistical flukes. But if this one is correct, then herd immunity to SARS-CoV-2 could be building faster than the commonly reported figures suggest. Then again, another recent study, also not yet peer-reviewed, suggests that not every case of infection may be contributing to herd immunity. Of 175 Chinese patients with mild symptoms of COVID-19, 70% developed strong antibody responses, but about 25% developed a low response, and about 5% developed no detectable response at all. Mild illness, in other words, might not always build up protection. Similarly, it will be important to study the immune response of people with asymptomatic cases of SARS-CoV-2 to determine whether symptoms and their severity predict whether a person becomes immune. The balance between these uncertainties will become clearer when with more serologic surveys or blood tests for antibodies are conducted in large numbers of people. Such studies are beginning and should show results soon. Of course, much will depend on how sensitive and specific the various tests are, how well they spot SARS-CoV-2 antibodies when those are present, and if they can avoid spurious signals from antibodies to related viruses. Even more challenging will be understanding what an immune response means for an individual's risk of getting reinfected and their contagiousness to others. Based on the volunteer experiments with seasonal coronaviruses and the antibody persistence studies for SARS and MERS, one might expect a strong immune response to SARS-CoV-2 to protect completely against reinfection, and a weaker one to protect against severe infection and to still slow the virus's spread. But designing valid epidemiologic studies to figure all this out is not easy. Many scientists, including several teams of which I'm a part, are working on the issue right now. One difficulty is that people with prior infection might differ from people who haven't yet been infected in many other ways that could alter their future risk of infection. Parsing the role of prior exposure from other risks is an example of the classic problem epidemiologists call confounding, and is made maddeningly harder today by the fast-changing conditions of the still-spreading SARS-CoV-2 pandemic. And yet, getting a handle on the fast is extremely important, not only to estimate the extent of herd immunity, but also to figure out whether some people can re-enter society safely without becoming infected again or serving as a vector and spreading the disease to others. Central to this effort will be figuring out how long protection lasts. With time, other aspects of immunity will become clearer as well. Experimental and statistical evidence suggests that infection with one coronavirus may offer some degree of immunity against distinct but related coronaviruses. Whether some people are at greater risk of or lesser risk of infection with SARS-CoV-2 because of a prior history of exposure to coronaviruses is an open question. And then there is a question of immune enhancement. Through a variety of mechanisms, immunity to coronavirus can in some instances exacerbate infection rather than prevent or mitigate it. This troublesome phenomenon is best known in another group of viruses, the flaviviruses, and may explain why administering a vaccine against dengue fever, a flavivirus infection, can sometimes make the disease worse. Still, mechanisms are still being studied for coronaviruses, but concern that they might be at play is that one of the obstacles that have slowed the development of experimental vaccines against SARS and MERS. Guarding against enhancement will be one of the biggest challenges facing scientists trying to develop vaccines for COVID-19. The good news is that research on SARS and MERS has begun to clarify how enhancement works, suggesting ways around it, and an extraordinary range of efforts is underway to find a vaccine for COVID-19 using multiple approaches. More science on almost every aspect of this new virus is needed. But in this pandemic, as with previous ones, decisions with great consequences must be made before definitive data are given. Given this urgency, the traditional scientific method, formulating informed hypotheses and then testing them by experiments and careful epidemiology, is hyper-accelerated. Given the public's attention, that work is unusually on display. In these difficult circumstances, I can only hope that this article will seem out of date very shortly, as much more is soon discovered about the coronavirus than what is known right now. Okay, and more news of potential immune responses. This from MSN. Recovered almost. China's early patients unable to shed coronavirus. Chinese doctors in Wuhan, where the virus first emerged in December, say a growing number of cases in which people recover from the virus but continue to test positive without showing symptoms is one of the biggest challenges as the country moves into a new phase of its containment battle. Those patients all tested negative for the virus at some point after recovering, but then tested positive again, some up to 70 days later, the doctor said. Many have done so over 50 to 60 days. The prospect of people remaining positive for the virus and therefore potentially infectious is of international concern, as many countries seek to end lockdowns and resume economic activity as the spread of the virus slows. Currently, the globally recommended isolation period after exposure is 14 days. So far, there have been no confirmations of newly positive patients infecting others, according to Chinese health officials. China has not published precise figures on how many patients fall into this category, but disclosures by Chinese hospitals to Reuters, as well as in other media reports, indicate there are at least dozens of such cases. In South Korea, about 1,000 people have been testing positive for 4 weeks or more. In Italy, the first European country ravaged by the pandemic, health officials noticed that coronavirus patients could test positive for the virus for about a month. As there is limited knowledge available on how infectious these patients are, doctors in Wuhan are keeping them in isolation for longer. Patients in China are discharged after 2 negative nucleic acid tests, taken at least 24 hours apart, and if they no longer show symptoms. Some doctors want this requirement to be raised to 3 tests or more. Experts and doctors struggle to explain why the virus behaves so differently in these people. Some suggest that patients retesting as positive after previously testing negative were somehow reinfected with the virus. This would undermine hopes that people catching COVID-19 would produce antibodies that would prevent them from getting sick again from the virus. Yong Eng-Kwang, director of the Korea Center for Disease Control and Prevention, has said the virus may have been reactivated in 91 South Korean patients who tested positive after being thought to be cleared of it. Other South Korean and Chinese experts have said that remnants of the virus could have stayed in the patient's systems but not be infectious or dangerous to the host or others. Paul Hunter, professor at the University of East Anglia's Norwich School of Medicine, said an unusually slow shedding of other viruses such as norovirus or influenza have been previously seen in patients with weakened immune systems. In 2015, South Korean authorities disclosed that they had a Middle East respiratory syndrome patient stricken with lymphoma who showed signs of the virus for 116 days. They said his impaired immune system kept his body from ridding himself of the virus. The lymphoma eventually caused his death. Yuan said that even if patients develop antibodies, it did not guarantee they would become virus-free. He said that some patients had high levels of antibodies and still tested positive to nucleic acid tests. It means that the two sides are still fighting, he said. Also, what is the latest on local testing and contact tracing? Well, I was told I was going to get an interview with our health commissioner, but that never happened. No notice, no cancellation, just AWOL. And in completely unrelated news, the Toledo Lucas County Health Department unveiled their new motto, "We're not the public servant of you." Okay, even with many unanswered questions, I have been able to get some info. The Toledo Lucas County Health Department has said that they will ramp up testing and test 10 to 15,000 people over the next month. There are currently 4 sites that are now operating drive-through testing by appointment only. To get an appointment, you need to fit into a priority group, most importantly, having symptoms or direct exposure to a known positive. They may be opening up testing to other groups, but it is not clear when or how. You can get more information on these testing sites at lucascountyhealth.com. That's lucascountyhealth.com. Okay, a key feature of this expanded drive-through testing is that apparently it is self-swabbing. In other words, if you want to get tested or have you have to perform the difficult and uncomfortable, even gagging procedure by sticking a long swab deep into your nose to the back of your throat. Normally, this procedure is done by a skilled health worker, but it looks like people will only get instructions and supervision to do this procedure on themselves. The good news, and perhaps the driver of this methodology, is that this procedure often results in gagging and coughing, which can lead to massive exposure to a health care worker performing the test. This self-swabbing can minimize this exposure and prevent the use of a lot of personal protective equipment. The bad news is that the reason the FDA has refused to allow test kits for use at home is simply because the swabbing procedure is very difficult to perform on oneself, and most importantly, because it is difficult to perform on oneself, so-called self-swabbing greatly increases the likelihood of an inadequate sample, making the test much less reliable in identifying true positives. In other words, this self-swabbing methodology results in many more false negatives. This has the dangerous side effect of people who are truly positive being faced with a false test result, perhaps assuming they are not infected when in fact they are. This could undermine both quarantine recommendations and practices for people with symptoms. This expanded testing seems like a great idea, but if self-swabbing is the collection method, then we may be creating more confusion and more dangerous behavior than if we just gave clear instructions for everyone with COVID-19-like symptoms to isolate. Also, the critical link to assuring that testing leads to fewer new infections is timely contact tracing. Very timely. If we continue to have testing limited largely to persons with symptoms, then we will never get ahead of this virus. Late timing looks something like this. Someone gets infected. They become infectious around day 3 or so. They get symptoms around day 5. After a little while with symptoms, they call to get tested, say the next day on day 6. If they call before 1 p.m., they can get a test the next day, day 7, otherwise day 8. You should get your result in 2 to 7 days. Let's be optimistic and say 2 days, which puts us at day 9 or 10. Then a contact tracer calls you, gets the names of your contact, and contacts all of them within 24 hours. This, optimistically, puts us at day 10 or 11 from infection. If the person tested infected people early on, before symptoms became apparent as COVID-19, say day 3 to 5, then by the time a contact tracer notifies them that they may have been exposed, it is 5 to 8 days later, and that's the optimistic take. And if they were infected, they would likely already have symptoms. Thus, the contact tracing provides limited benefit. Just repeat this cycle over and over. This is what we call an epidemic. Largely unmitigated transmission of a highly contagious virus, a virus which is transmitted even before symptoms appear. Without widespread testing of asymptomatic people with quick turnaround of test results and speedy contact tracing, we are left largely as historians of the virus's path rather than breakers of transmission. Without such a system, physical distancing and hygiene practices are our only defense, and it's hard to win playing only defense. It's like trying to win a war by building enough field hospitals, even if a heroic effort. Okay, so can we build such a functioning system of widespread rapid testing and speedy contact tracing? Well, we do have some good news. The bill just passed in Congress does appropriate about $25 billion for expanded testing and surveillance. That's about $11 billion for states to support increased testing and surveillance. Another $2 billion for states and local health departments on top of their supplemental public health emergency preparedness grants, and an additional $4.25 billion based on the number of COVID-19 cases you have in the state or locality, another $750 million to the Indian Health Service, which Indian territories have been a large hit, another $1 billion to the CDC, and about $3 billion to other federal agencies for testing, research, and other support. This is good news to see substantial resources applied to this challenge. The question for the next few weeks or months is, can we even buy our way out of a testing problem without a coherent national plan? Waiting waist-high in $100 bills may not be enough to deal with shortages of reagents, swabs, transport solutions, and lab personnel. Also, the leadership that needs to happen at the state and local levels needs to meet a quite high standard in service delivery. Only fair quality testing, even if widespread, will not be enough to get ahead of this epidemic. Only fair contact tracing, even if for every identified infection, will not be enough to get ahead of this epidemic. Both testing and contact tracing each need to be running simultaneously and well synchronized. Okay. With even crude surveillance data, we do know that nursing homes are hard hit around the country. So what's the latest nursing home data for Lucas County? Well, we know that 132 residents have tested positive in 19 nursing homes and 64 staff in 20 nursing homes. There's about 10 that are just one or the other of either staff or nursing. So in total, we have a couple dozen nursing homes with 196 identified infections. This makes Lucas County the highest rate of infection in nursing homes of any Ohio county. Okay, folks, well, like usual, I'm running over here with more material that I can cover in an hour, but I'm going to stop and see you next week. See you then. Stay healthy. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. and let's take it home with Emma's Revolution.
I need some justice.